All right. Excited to have Amanda on the show today. Amanda, would you mind introducing yourself and maybe telling us a little bit about your role at Pangaea?
Yeah, thanks. I'm really happy to be here. So I'm Amanda Parks. My job title is Chief Innovation Officer at Pangaea. And basically, I am part of the founding team and in charge of our science. So our scientific strategy, along with our head of R&D, working on, you know, basically how we plan everything from sourcing our materials, that sort of very early stage, you know, things that were going straight into product, all the way up through all of our collaborations, co-developments, and looking at also very early stage development with university labs or investment in startups. So kind of spanning the globe of what we do from a scientific perspective and, you know, defining really our goals and priorities as well in that space. And how do we really take on these complex issues of sustainability as it's related to science?
Yeah, it's been fascinating for me to watch from the sidelines what you're all building. And, you know, I see that the brand sort of somewhat identifies as a materials science company and not necessarily just a traditional clothing brand. And as you sort of spoke to your job description, there's obviously more than just being a clothing brand going on. So can you tell us a little bit about like what makes Pangaea a materials science company and what that means to you?
Yeah. So I sometimes call us a material science company that manifests as a fashion brand. So it's sort of like what you see, that comes out of the water, but all the other stuff that's going on underneath is really very much material science based. And I think from the first principles, we were really innovation driven. And I think that that's just a starting point of a differentiation. And a lot of the founding team came, we were working together formerly on an investment fund called Future Tech Lab, which was looking at these new material technologies around sustainability and textiles and kind of materials in general. And we're doing investments and kind of really scoping hardcore into this space. And the whole idea behind Pangaea really comes from how do we put those materials to use and expand that, and also expand that further into the industry. As you know, we have a B2B part of our platform as well. So we're selling to the public through our direct-to-consumer channels, but we are also selling materials and textiles to spread what we're developing. So I think that's also a differentiator. And then secondly, we really like to think about product in a different way than traditional fashion cycles. So we don't necessarily have seasons. We might have some upgrades and colors and that kind of thing. But what we're really trying to do is release an innovation when it's ready. So I worked in the traditional tech industry, coming from a background in lab science. And if you look at tech companies, they will kind of release something when it's ready, like say the iPhone, and then they'll do an upgrade when the new hardware is ready or the new software. And they're in this continual state of upgrading. And that's how we like to think of our materials as well. We have lifestyle basics. We augment that with some more specialized pieces. But really what we're always looking at is how do we get the materials in our clothing to be better? How do we expand our materials library so that there's specific innovations that are right for, you know, how the functionality of a garment, how we want it to behave, how we want it to look and feel. So that's kind of, I think, where we're different. We have, you know, we're guided by materials first.
I find all that stuff to be interesting. And I think the approach that the brand has taken as far as bringing collaborators into the equation is intelligent and continuing to evolve and not sort of, for lack of a better phrase, like die on a very specific innovation hill and be so rigid as to never try to evolve that thing and sort of declare that yours is the best and there is no other. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, collaboration obviously with other innovators is part of, and that seems actually very counter to the way other brands are approaching their product offerings. So can you just tell me how that sort of like best idea won in the room a little bit? How did you get there?
First of all, for me personally, I spent a lot of years at the MIT Media Lab doing lab research, and before that I was at Stanford. And one of the things that you really learn in creative environments like that, creative environments with technology, is that the best ideas come from these diverse places. And that there's a lot of people, I think, that they may seem like competitors, but they actually work much better as collaborators. And in some ways, academia definitely has competition, but they are actually a lot better at the collaboration. So there's a mindset there that is, we shouldn't be having to do everything alone. That's not the best use of the best brains in the world. When we think about it from a lab research point of view, we want the very best of a professor working in a particular field, lending some of his or her time to get the innovation right, right? And then leave them in their lab, getting on to the next thing. And then the other part of this was that having worked both with a lot of startups personally, founding a couple, and then working also on the fund side, you start to realize very quickly that there's this kind of valley of death that goes in between kind of a lab prototype phase and getting to full commercialization. And it's partly about, can be about funding, but that's going to be a little bit better on the material side as we move away from kind of digital only investments and also people realizing that investing in things for the future of the earth is actually both good for us and potentially good financially. But also on top of that, there's really this kind of mismatch between how scientific and technology startups work and how big fashion companies work. I mean, literally there's a language mismatch, how they talk to each other. And what I was seeing a lot is the people on the science side and tech side would get it to a particular place. And then the fashion industry needed kind of them to be a little bit further. Like they weren't meeting in the middle in quite the right way. And the projects would die based on very small things, right? And so what we were taking on is this role to kind of create this bridge where we know how the science is working, but we also have a full development supply chain. So creating textiles, doing the testing, everything up through making product, selling, you know, e-com, everything about building a brand. And the kind of thing is that, you know, we don't need to have scientists with early stage tech companies building fashion brands. That's not the goal of this. And so we can be that bridge to get the material into a product sooner. We can also have a full loop of feedback, meaning that we can go literally, like in one of our collaborations that's happening right now, one of our main partners, Kintra Fibers, they are designing a new fully bio-based, biodegradable nylon alternative. And this would be a major breakthrough. We're early investors, lead investors, co-developing, and working very closely from literally molecular structure of the chemistry all the way through to figuring out how the product works, looks, and feels. And almost no one ever gets that chance to go from literally the chemist into the garment. And so this just gives quicker feedback. We can speed up all the loops and all of that. So that's where we see it as really important. And I also like to point out in this space, we actually need all the innovation. So even there might be, you know, dozens or at least a dozen kind of, say, for example, new startups working on the alternative leather space. So, you know, vegan, non-animal, et cetera. And really the true competition is the conventional leather system and conventional farming. We need lots of different opportunities in this space. And we don't actually want to think about a single one of them winning. There's actually a space for all those based on, you know, performance of the material, cost, where it's coming from. Like this whole idea about sustainability is not about ever finding one perfect solution. It's always about a series of priorities and compromises. And it's very much based on where you are, what you're trying to accomplish, and those sorts of things. So it's really about expanding that in the same way that nature functions best when you have biodiversity. We really see that in the same way for the material ecology and economy of our brand.
Yeah, I mean, again, like from the sideline, I wouldn't say it seems like a no-brainer to me, but it feels like a very intelligent and dynamic set of thinkers, you know, that obviously have reached the conclusions that you just laid out. Because, you know, for me, it feels like I understand competition, obviously, but I think that the competition sometimes is to the detriment of the speed of the innovation and the shared information around it. So it is very refreshing to hear you all sort of talk about it in that way and think about how to bring more people into it and how to learn from one another as opposed to trying to knock everybody off whatever perch you're on, you know.
And also, I think there's something to that is really quite unique about the fashion industry itself and fashion brands. You know, everyone is differentiating themselves based on aesthetic and kind of, it's, you know, fashion is a means of personal expression. And there's such a beauty in the diversity of brands. So this idea around kind of trying to keep exclusivity on a material seems counterintuitive to me about, you know, your fashion label should differentiate itself on what it makes, why it makes it, how it identifies itself as a brand, and not, you know, necessarily just in, you know, the components and materials. So I think if you look at something like, you know, the Intel model, and this is me, you know, kind of learning and coming from tech and being surprised by how fashion functioned, you know, lots of different computers have Intel chips inside of them that make them work very powerfully. But, you know, the brand differentiators between Apples and PCs and Androids are, you know, they're there for, in different ways. And so we're kind of thinking about fashion that way. And I think that it seemed like a sort of a no-brainer to me, but but that's because I came into fashion through the back door, right? And I didn't know how things were supposed to work. So it is that great, again, this crossover of kind of, you know, multidisciplinary people, our founding team. And as we expand, we have a lot of people that are not from traditional fashion backgrounds, are kind of learning from finance and media and all sorts of other areas, environmental science. And I think that's really important to our way of thinking. But if, to me, it also seemed just like a massive opportunity within fashion to, for us to kind of own the means of our own future within the industry, like instead of waiting for somebody outside of the fashion industry to create the textiles that we need, we can start to determine that and kind of be, you know, that's also how tech companies work. They are always working 5-10 years out. What do we want the future to look like? We're designing it inside now.
Yeah, I can relate in a lot of ways, just because for me personally, starting Future World was not, I don't come from the editorial space. I come from making commercials for a living. I come from being a creative storyteller, a little bit of a design sort of like nucleus. And it felt to me like I didn't want to come to these conversations with the rigid sort of thinking, with the shame of the, like, as a vegan, like that culture has its own sort of like negativity around it and stigma around it. So, you know, similar to you and the way that Pangaea has approached a lot of different things, it's nice to have the opportunity to observe first and then step into something and sort of bring those learnings, as opposed to just having come up in that one way and believing that it's like this way or the highway. So
like the power of naivete in a certain sense.
Yeah, very much so.
You have a lot of knowledge in one area, but naivete about how things are supposed to work. I also do want to say, though, that, you know, we're a new brand, and so we're designing everything from scratch. And one of the things that's hardest about what's going on right now in sustainability is that these, you know, big fashion companies and, you know, or small ones, but people who have been around for a long time do have established ways of doing things. And it's harder to change those than it is to start from fresh. So we understand that. And there's a lot of, you know, what's that phrase about moving the ship, you know, the ship is going in one direction, you have to very slowly kind of guide it back in. So we have a lot of sympathy. I feel like the future from an internal standpoint has a lot of positivity, and people want to make change inside of those companies. And it's really about, it's a big, big thing to take on, to, you kind of have to shift business models. I mean, that's how we think about it, that our business model is slightly different in terms of where we put our money, where, you know, where we invest. You know, we have a full, from our very founding, we have a full impact team of people analyzing supply chain, and then a whole team of scientists, which is pretty rare. It's not an afterthought.
Yeah. Well, that leads me to one of the questions I had, which was about the philanthropy and how that is sort of tied into what the brand is doing and feels like an essential component. Can you tell me a little bit about what that sort of currently looks like and how that continues to evolve sort of into the future?
Yeah, absolutely. So philanthropy is also completely at our core. And that goes down to, you know, there's lots of different ways to think about philanthropy. One of the things we certainly didn't want it to be was this idea of some brands or potentially companies, they'll do a lot of bad in their standard practice and then give money on the side. That's not corporate social responsibility, right? It has to, first of all, come from your core, that everything we're doing, first of all, is, you know, we're paying fair wages, checking supply chains, do no harm first and foremost, right? Do the best practices. So that in itself is just a form of philanthropy for the earth and for people trying to work in the industry. And then on top of that, of course, we think it feeds perfectly back into, you know, the things that we're doing. So for example, we have a fund that's about bees. So thinking about the future of pollinators, we're all about biodiversity, trying to use all different kinds of plants. And of course, you know, protecting the bees helps the world, also helps us do what we need to do. And so it's really about trying to take on sophisticated causes in sort of deep ways. And then also, you know, we give back around, you know, we plant trees for each purchase, and we work with the UN. We also work with artists who are doing different initiatives around the space. You might've seen Takashi Murakami, and we just recently launched last weekend with Andy the Pink on a whole initiative. So that also raises consciousness. And so we're trying to kind of get at it from multiple directions, like supporting science, directly supporting initiatives in the space, and then also thinking about culture and what that means to get more people involved. Because that is a form of philanthropy, kind of giving back with our time and our media and our kind of presence. So yeah, so the multiple different levels on that. I should also say I'm not in charge of that. So maybe I'm missing something. No.
It's funny. The first time I think I saw the brand or was exposed to the brand was at a UN event. And then even as recently as this weekend, our executive editor texted me on a Saturday that like, hey, did you see this Vandy the Pink Pangaea collaboration? And so I just find that you all are doing a very good job of like creating a lot of tentacles and trying to find touch points beyond just the people who are there at the UN for a week talking about climate change. You know, it's like, that's not going to do it, you know?
It's kind of, because there's a lot of audiences we can speak to that is sort of, you know, preaching the converted, right? So I think opening it up culturally. Yeah, Vandy and I were on stage chatting at Nordstrom's on Saturday, and he has, you know, super fans that I'm on stage talking about science and, you know, deep things about fibers. But from my perspective, it's exciting to be in a company that really embraces the notion of science education as part of what we're doing, that it doesn't have to be super nerdy. We can make it fun. No one's shying away from using the big words, but we do spend a lot of time, energy, and resources into making the science kind of approachable and understandable, and kind of making people try to feel empowered that they can understand it. As a former professor, that's for sure something that I feel a lot of personal integrity around, that, you know, science is not for boys, you know, girls can understand science too, and all, you know, all of that stuff. It can be cool, it can be stylish, it can be fun, and that does play into kids, well, you know, Gen Z, Gen Alpha, like wanting to get involved. We need them to care about this. So, yeah.
Yeah, I love sort of practical applications, and because I feel like for a lot of people that are trying to get more educated on these issues, they see these terms that are popular or trending in these conversations, and sometimes they don't know what they mean. So I want to dig into one of those terms and one of those concepts, and I want to hear what you think about it. So microplastics, everyone is talking about microplastics. So I've seen and heard you speak a little bit about how materials break down when they're washed, and I think everyone has that level of understanding, but can you just give us a little bit about that and a little bit about sort of how to wash our clothes and how that sort of ties into what Pangaea is making and learnings, and give us the microplastics riff.
Yeah, so this is super timely because we recently won the Microfiber Innovation Challenge from Conservation X Labs, which was a big deal for a new innovation that we're working on with MTIX, which is, let me get real technical now, micro laser surface enhancement.
I love a good micro laser surface enhancement.
Exactly. I know, everyone does. But the point being more that I think that, first of all, when we come from this idea of do no harm, this is one of the first places where if you're using cellulosic natural materials without toxic chemistry in terms of treatments and dyes, that's one of the secret things about fashion. You can have a fully organic t-shirt that's dyed with something terrible and suddenly it doesn't biodegrade anymore. You know, there's all these like secret things that can happen in factories that you aren't as aware of. So just first of all, starting to think about using natural materials which don't make microplastics. They could make microfibers. And this is a point of, we're still kind of very early on in understanding the long-term effects of this on the environment, like in terms of the studies and how do we analyze it. But at least we know that if, you know, organic cotton, non-treated organic cotton ends up wherever in a landfill in the ocean, it's not going to end up as a plastic particulate. And that's the first key thing. And then you might have heard me talk about the example of, okay, like reclaiming ocean plastic. It's such a great idea. We need to get the plastic out of the ocean. But one of the worst things to possibly do with that is to turn it back into fibers and then put those fibers back into water, because recycled plastic, recycled nylon or PET is generally lower quality than virgin. So it breaks down more easily, creates more microplastics. So you're potentially exacerbating a problem. And one of the worst ones I think of is like swimwear, like, it seems sort of, there's a sort of logic to it about, oh, I took this plastic out of the ocean, I'll make it into a swimsuit for the beach. And it's like, we want to put it in things that are buried, you know, playground matting, or, you know, things that like don't, I mean, and I'm not sure that that's the best one, but things that are kind of will be contained and not be continuously washed. So that's one way to think about it. And then in terms of like, you know, we're working on solutions for synthetics like Kintra, which doesn't actually, you know, because it's bio-based and biodegradable, it doesn't give off microplastics, but can have the same functionality, because people do love synthetics for their functionality. We're not giving up our spandex and our athleisure. And 60% of all garments right now have some form of synthetics in them, which is kind of terrifying. So not all solutions will come from purely, quote, natural or cellulosic resources. So we can still have some synthetics like Hintra that can work without the microplastics. And then this other treatment that we're doing with MTIX is to basically, it's almost like a sealant. You change the molecular surface structure of a textile so that it doesn't break down. And so there's some kind of new technologies along the way. And then there's a whole lot of other kind of biosynthetics coming down the chain. So that's on the material side. And one of the things I do want to say is I would love for us to solve this problem. So it's not about consumer behavior, right? Anything that we can do that makes it invisible to consumer is better. But on the other side, we do still have a lot of synthetics out there. So, you know, I think there's the things that they're kind of common sense. Like there's some filters for your washing machine that you can do like bags, or there's something that you can collect the microfibers. I wish this was a standard part in washing machines, you know, but that, why don't we just do that? But, and then there's, you know, also washing your clothes on lower temperatures, using natural based soaps and detergents, washing your clothes less. One of the things we do is put peppermint treatment on our clothes, which keeps them fresher longer. That kind of, it works like a natural antibacterial. So yeah. And also I think also particularly in America, people wash their clothes really a lot, like more. So just kind of, yeah, just cut down on it a little bit, but it's pretty much common sense on the consumer side. There's a lot of other technological things that we're trying to do and making progress on.
Cool. That's super helpful. And it's nice to just sort of like hear it in conversation as opposed to now I need to read the thesis on microplastics, you know, to try to understand.
Yeah. And I think also, I mean, we're literally as a scientific community still learning about this. So I think that it's always important to recognize that it's still pretty early that we're discovering all the ways. We're just thinking about, well, what happens with like shoe rubber, you know, the bottom of soles, and where does that end up, the stuff on the ground, and, you know, just like microplastics in the air. Like there's a lot of different kind of terrifying things to study. So we're getting there. And so things may, you know, we may start changing, but even making standards on measurement is something that we're doing now as part of this competition that we won with Conservation X Labs. So getting the right people together to think about it and work on it is, I think, the most important thing. And then not, you know, we can't beat up the public. Like it's not the consumer's fault. That's one of the things that it's very key. Like if someone's selling you a really terrible, like polyester that breaks down in the wash, like that's not okay.
I love a good conversation around standardization also. It's a huge thing that I really feel like we will get to a little bit of soon in this conversation, but I really don't understand how we've avoided it for as long as we have.
Right.
And I think that it's really made this moment even more complicated and sort of slower to the type of progress that we could be making if we could just get standardization around what's in these things, how they get made, et cetera. And I mean, yes, we are turning the ship a little bit, but I would have hoped that by now the ship would be entirely in a different direction. So here's a fun one. Pricing.
Okay, yeah.
And value. Two things that I think, and it sort of goes to your most recent point, it's like there's a lot of blaming and a lot of pointing towards the consumer for buying the fast fashion or buying the thing that like isn't good enough, doesn't meet all of the perfect criteria, right? But I think that, you know, a lot of people have been conditioned to not understand where value and price sort of like meet in the middle, because there's also this world of overpaying for things that just have a brand name attached to them. So yeah, so I would love to just hear a little bit about where you feel like Pangaea is hitting the pricing and value and how the consumer should sort of understand and receive that information.
Yeah. So I think first of all, pointing out like fast fashion prices, they're arbitrarily low. Like someone is paying for that at some point in supply chain. And so there's really no reason why a t-shirt should cost $3, like from a material standpoint, from a labor standpoint, from a shipping standpoint. So that the fast fashion business model is literally a race to the bottom, and it is so slowly dying out. But that's, you know, kind of only started happening in like the 90s. So we sort of have like a generation who've lived with it. But first of all, kind of getting rid of that stereotype that, oh, like t-shirts should cost like $7. No, that's not like, just, let's just think about value. Like no one thinks that iPhone should cost $30. Right. So like just based on materials and functionality. So I think there's that piece of it. And then absolutely with Pangaea, we are trying to kind of sit, you know, in the middle. Like we absolutely, first of all, fast fashion going away, and then there's kind of high street, and we're a little bit above that, but by no means a luxury. And the point is that we do put more investment and money up front into our materials, and also all the money we spend on R&D and impact, you know, environmental science goes into those costs just as a company. We operate a little bit more like a tech startup in a way that we've like raised capital, and which is not exactly in the same way that a fashion brand would. And we have IP, and we, you know, it's kind of this hybrid model, which so far is working, but it is an experiment for sure in how we do that. So our pricing sits at a place where we think that it is affordable, but it's by no means the cheapest thing out there. It's absolutely not meant to be about arbitrarily raising the price because of our branding. But what our branding should signify to people is very high quality materials that last and age well. And I think one of the things that we saw during the pandemic, when we were starting to sell more and more sweatsuits, I mean, yeah, sustainable sweatsuits for sale during the pandemic, work from home gear, right? We would see somebody buy, they're, you know, testing out, they buy one sweatshirt and they come back and buy 6 tracksuits for their whole family. And, you know, and then we get these messages like, I never want to take it off. It's the softest thing ever. And we're very, very aware of, like, because we're cultivating the textiles from scratch, we are absolutely analyzing everything about it. And, most fashion companies aren't doing that. They're just sourcing, oh, this feels good, great. And then it's like a kind of race to get it out for the next season. You know, some of the materials, our fruit fiber and plant fiber, we worked on them for almost 2 years to get them to the state that they're in. And those are materials that have no cotton in them. They feel like a kind of luxurious jersey and t-shirts and sweatshirts, but they are made from mostly agricultural waste, seaweed, eucalyptus, et cetera, and, you know, plant and literally banana waste, pineapple waste, et cetera. So kind of just working on the blending and just taking a very scientific approach to how things feel, I think is where we try to think about the quality and value of a garment. I will say, so we make products that are meant to last, but I also think there's this other part of the equation in terms of what fashion does culturally that fast fashion really played into, this idea of getting the new kind of, you know, piece of personal expression, what I'm going to wear this weekend, et cetera. And what we have now is a much better system set up to digitally satisfy those cravings. And so I think of things like rental, right? So, and swapping and sharing and resale. So I'm a huge Rent the Runway fan, and I can get that rush of trying something out, you know, wearing it just once, being able to send it back. So all the surrounding models, so not just, there's a lot of pieces, new pieces of fashion that's not just about consumerism, it's about experience. So experiential companies creating those, even digital, like virtual fashion, you know, wardrobes and stuff, the way people identify online. So I'm also hoping that that is starting to kill off the fast fashion. I know that, like, my niece who's 13, she's super into thrifting, which I love, right? So, and I didn't even, you know, I didn't infect her with that, but so just kind of that, we don't want to lose fashion's identity as like personal expression and all the fun and joy and beauty that comes out of it. So we just need to have the models, the business models, and the right kind of, just setting up the right experiential incentives for people to kind of not, that you can buy, you can buy a few good things, keep them, you can, you know, swap and have other models for the kind of stuff that you want, you know, is more, quote, disposable.
I think that was a great synopsis of it. And I also feel like the Pangaea garment has, in my perception, become a little bit of like a badge. There's truth in labeling on, I mean, can you talk to someone who hasn't seen it? Can you explain? Yeah.
Yeah. So for people who don't know of our brand, we have a text block on the top right hand or on the bottom left, or, you know, on pants or whatever, wherever it fits, that describes basically what it's made of and how it's made very succinctly. And we spend a lot of time honing in on these text blocks. You can imagine, like, word for word, because it's got to be printed on there. But the point is that, and it doesn't even say Pangaea, but the point is the font, the, you know, the size, et cetera, you can identify it as us, but it also is information. So it's literally like the medium is the message, quite frankly. So sort of it's iconic, even if you don't know what it says. But then when you read it, it gives you a baseline of information. And then all of our clothes also have a digital identity through Eon ID. There's a QR code that you can drill down and get a lot more information. But yeah, just that idea of I'm willing to literally wear this on my sleeve, like what my garment's made of.
Yeah, very cool. And I see a lot of ambassadors around Brooklyn, I can tell you that much.
It's starting to grow. It's very exciting for me because, you know, we were much bigger in Europe first, right? Our headquarters are in London. So now that our ads and stuff are all around my neighborhood, it feels great. And people, too, of course, wearing stuff.
Yeah, it's cool. I always get, it's a good sign to me that people, you know, are voting with the new purchases that they make, because obviously you're only selling new garments at this point. So I do always get a little bit of a charge out of that when I see it, when someone's actually making, you know, a vote that they're proud enough to wear it on their shirt that they care about what materials are in it. So this is a perfect segue to, drum roll please, the New York State Fashion Sustainability Act, which for anyone who is unfamiliar, we'll put some info on it in the show notes. But I've also felt a lot of good energy around this act. So it's gaining momentum. I first was familiarized with it via New Standard Institute and some friends and acquaintances over there. Since it's a big part of something that you're all focusing on, can you talk a little bit about, you know, your interpretation of it, what the goals are, and explain for people like why it's exciting to you and the brand?
Jeff, I'm super happy to see, you know, things happening in the space, although I think there is a lot of caveats. And I will kind of be a disclaimer that I've studied, you know, I've looked into it, et cetera, but I do not consider myself an expert in policymaking around, you know, how these things work. So it's exciting just to think that really the focus is on transparency, that there's a lot of power in just disclosure and that idea that kind of the public, can we start there? And the, you know, instead of saying you have to do everything right, you're saying you just have to, first of all, know and understand what you do and tell people what you do. And that could be enough just for brands to change their practices, just knowing that they could be outed. One thing I will say, and this is because we are doing it, is it's extremely hard. It's a lot of work, time, energy, resources, you know, specialized people into getting all this information. And so, I mean, I'm worried that we're going to have to see how this rolls out, but I'm more worried that there's going to be some kind of crazy workarounds where the brands don't do the work. Or, you know, I think for me, it's more about thinking about the incentive and the motivation, where for us, we like to think about, you know, sustainable choices, responsible innovation choices are also good for the financial bottom line of our company, and they should be for other companies. And that's, I don't mean that cynically. I just mean that it's like, you can't survive as a business if you're not making money. And we need to adjust all innovation and you know, supply chain issues to work like with that and not against it. And so I get worried that if it's, what is the reporting mechanism? These little details about, you know, how the way that people get around tax loopholes and stuff, right? So maybe I'm a little bit cynical on that part, but I'm trying to think about what's the best way to motivate brands to do it from a financial bottom line where they can see that it's good and not just from a shaming perspective, right? So that's how I want to see. I think it's an experiment, and I'm pro something happening. I think the other thing is that, you know, what happens with a lot of laws, especially around new innovation, is they're not written, or the laws is like sort of behind the innovation or the technology. I mean, we saw it with internet laws, right? Like that's why Napster existed, right? Because it just wasn't a law. But I think there's certain things about, say, material categories, that new materials that we're working on and working with, they don't have categories. And so they get misclassified as something that's close enough to it, but then it ends up being in this huge tax problem. And, you know, there is an issue when legislation doesn't make like kind of logical or scientific sense. And that's because the people making the laws are not kind of not forward thinking enough, or don't have enough knowledge about the science to be projecting. It's just really hard to kind of stay abreast on the latest development. So I do believe that we need more kind of standardization, and regulation can help. I especially love the science-based targets part of it. But I'm also worried, just from kind of playing devil's advocate, is like, if we don't want to over-regulate to the point where we're stopping innovation or anything like that. So it's a delicate balance.
Yeah, I think it is definitely a delicate balance. It's nice to feel energy moving toward clarity.
Yeah.
There's obviously various certifications that exist. that I feel like brands are, you know, deservedly so quick to wear as a badge of honor. I sort of hope that these things are celebrated, you know? So if, for argument's sake, if brands are willing to give themselves up to this level of transparency around something like the Sustainability Act and open themselves up to the scrutiny, which everyone is ready to scrutinize everyone for everything, and I feel like it makes brands hesitant to try new things sometimes, it'd be nice to see the brands that are paying their workers fairly, you know, ensuring that there's not toxic dyes being used on their garments, that brands that are being mindful of the carbon footprint in a real meaningful way, not making up potentially arbitrary scores around certain things. It'd be nice to see the consumer, you know, be able to reward, or those brands be subsidized to be able to sort of rise to the top.
It's actually kind of what the next thing I was going to say was, really thinking about how to incentivize it as opposed to make it a fee. So like, or, you know, like a, or something that you get a punishment. So is it a tax break if you do disclose? And there like multiple kind of motivations around that. And I am worried. So less about the fashion brands themselves, they can usually afford this, especially the big ones. But if there's a lot of pressure being put on, you know, partners, fabrication and manufacturing partners down the supply chain, they're really working on like razor thin margins. And if all of the burden of this gets shunted onto the factories, that's where we're going to see people trying to maneuver to get out of it if they don't have the resources. And so I think there has to be a fairness there to make sure that it doesn't all get shunted to people who are already almost, you know, barely breaking even. So yeah, that's kind of where I sit on that. But we have to kind of try. So
yeah. Yeah, progress over perfection. That's the name of the podcast, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'll give you the opportunity to sort of close on anything that you're really excited to talk about, or any sort of parting shots, or any, you know, hot takes on who's going to win the World Series this year, or whatever's on your mind. So the floor is yours. Anything you want to just sort of punctuate or leave us with anything, or favorite coffee spot?
Single thing about baseball. So I'm feeling cautiously optimistic about the future, and just, we've seen a lot of movement with, you know, new fundraising. So I'm bringing up money, not because I care so much about money, but because there is a follow the money and you'll see where the innovation breakthroughs are, right? We need to get the capital in there. So for example, like with mycelium leather, like Michael Works just raised, you know, $120 million for a new whole manufacturing scale up. And this whole idea of some of these startups, which have been kind of, you know, in lab and prototype stage for quite a while, which seems like a long time in fashion years, like 5-6, but in science years, it's very quick. They're starting to really come to fruition, and there's real product coming out. And, you know, the industry is starting to take notice, and things are, I do feel like things are starting to speed up. So yeah, I mean, I think what I would like to see more collaboration, people being open, this kind of, you know, we have to get there together, and there's lots of ways we can all have growth and make profit within, you know, I always lecture about donut economics, which is one of my favorite theories about living within the planetary boundaries, where there's a base, there's a floor that protects people and wildlife, and then you don't go outside of it. But the right people can continue to grow and be profitable around this, you know, working with nature and with biological systems. So we talk a lot about return to the bioeconomy and the biocycle, and the more that we can do to kind of think about the highest levels of tech and science and using that to augment natural processes and better understand them and study them and study the entire life cycle. So deep studies into things like microfibers, but also biodegradability, compostability. We don't fully understand all of that either yet. So that's, yeah, I think that's where I want to see deeper dives, is like all of the back end on the product. So we're getting there slowly.
Cool. Well, I love some cautious optimism, and I love collaboration. So I want to say thanks for coming on the show. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you, and I feel very lucky that I get to have these conversations with so many interesting people. And yeah, I hope you have a great rest of the day. Thanks for being part of this.
Thanks so much for having me. This was great.